Chapter 23, Since I've Been Loving You. November 2010. I love TV. I didn't get to watch much as a kid, so I made up for it as an adult. Before binging shows was a thing, I could lose myself in TV, watching episode after episode. Friday Night Lights, Weeds, Californication. At this time, our show was Parenthood. I called it our show, but Eric isn't someone who can just sit and watch a show like me. He needs to be moving around. On the morning of November 11th, I was mainlining the second season on DVD, crying with the Bravermans and Eric's big Yale sweatshirt and the underwear I called my ruffle butt panties. I heard Led Zeppelin blaring from the direction of my bedroom upstairs. He came into the living room and he saw me literally crying from the television show I was watching. "You gotta see what Bentley did upstairs," he said. Bentley was his dog, an Airedale Terrier. I had grown to think of him as mine, too. "Babe, I'm totally lost in the middle of this," I said. He went upstairs and called down, "There's something wrong with Bentley." I jumped up and ran up those stairs now, worried about Bentley. But when I got to our bedroom, Bentley was fine, and Eric was out on the balcony, where there were rose petals all over. I realized my favorite song was playing, Led Zeppelin's Since I've Been Loving You, from the How the West Was Won live album. I walked to him slowly, realizing what was happening. When I got to him, he got down on one knee, presenting a beautiful diamond and ruby ring. I was so overcome, I sat down on his knee. "Whoa," I said. "I know it's only been 6 months," he said, "but I know that the rest of my life is yours if you'll have me." It was an immediate yes. I enjoyed him, my best friend, and the hard stuff and the fun stuff. I didn't ever want to sleep without him next to me. We understood each other when nobody else ever seemed to. Eric timed the proposal for exactly 11-11-11 on November 11th. He knew 11-11 has always been a special time for me for some reason. I happened to look at the clock at that exact moment and freaked my girlfriends out by telling them to make a wish. "I know you would not want to be anywhere but your home when I asked you," he said. Anybody who knew my heart knew that was true. I would not have wanted to say yes to forever in front of anybody else or anywhere else. "But how did you know that I wanted a ruby?" I almost yelled. "Because I know you," he said. "It's your birthstone, and I know what's sentimental to you." He told me my mom helped him pick out the ring, and she told me he paid for it himself. It's so funny because he lived so simply that I always assumed he had no money. But all those years playing in the NFL, he'd saved. We kissed, and by then the record had gone through Stairway to Heaven and started Eric's favorite, Going to California. "Your bags are packed," he said. "I'm taking you up to San Ysidro Ranch. It's a hotel that's one of the most romantic places in the world." He confided his proposal plan to Lolo because she brought us together in the first place, and she suggested it as the perfect getaway. "How did you do all this?" I asked. How long had I been watching Parenthood? "I just did," he said. It was about a 3.5-hour drive to San Ysidro, and we called all of our loved ones on the way. He told me he had asked my parents' permission, and they'd given their blessing. None of my friends were shocked, or at least nobody said they were. Everybody knew we were meant to be together. We already had a plan. We would get married the following year, so our wedding date would be 11-11-11. I remember looking out on the coastline, thinking that now more than ever I wanted that wished-for baby girl. "Trust God's timing," I told myself. "She'll appear." The following summer, a year into trying to have a baby, I kept a stash of pregnancy tests in the downstairs bathroom. I didn't want them in my bathroom because I would constantly see them. I just needed to know they were there when I was ready. When I had the surgery to remove my right fallopian tube as a teenager, the doctor said I would likely only be able to get pregnant every other month. Then it didn't seem like a big deal. Now it seemed like it cut my chances in half. It was summer, a month where I would be ovulating on my left side, where I still had a fallopian tube. Those months were always full of hope. I'd been trying ever since Capri. I know that there are people who've waited longer or have been told more definitively that they will not be able to conceive or bring a baby to term. I am in no way comparing heartaches. For me, passing the year mark was hard. I wasn't ready to start monitoring when I was ovulating because I was afraid of realizing I had a real issue. But I took a pregnancy test every month, just in case. And this time, the not pregnant sign on the test hurt my heart. I needed Eric. He was outside at the glass table with Master Wong, who was visiting. They were sipping tea, and Eric was listening intently to his old mentor. Master Wong was a powerful man, somehow young and old at the same time, and able to command any room he's in with silence. Eric always said he gave it to him straight and had no time for the trappings of ego or excuses. I went outside to Eric, crying uncontrollably, a year's worth of tears coming out. "I'm not pregnant," I said, "and I'm never gonna be pregnant, and I just want to be a mom." Master Wong paused a long time, seeing the hurt in my eyes. He softened. "Let me try a treatment on you," he said, "an adjustment." I'm not a doctor, chiropractor, or nuclear scientist, so this is not advice. But we went inside, and he somehow knew that my issue was on my right side, where my fallopian tube had been removed. He did an adjustment that I can only describe as popping my pelvis. I asked God to make this work. The summer continued, and I saved photos of wedding dresses on my phone for a November wedding. In August, Eric and I headed to Watch Hill, Rhode Island, for a getaway with his parents. He was intent on getting me on a bike to tour the area. I resisted and was irritable about it. Just felt a little off. But Eric won out, taking me out on 10 to 20 mile bike rides. It was beautiful there, with old Victorian style cottages that are really these sprawling mansions by the ocean. We watched the sunset, and I was proud we got through our bickering and gone riding. Go team. When we got home, we still had the cycling bug, and we made plans to see Eric's friends in Venice. It was morning, and Eric was upstairs in the shower. I was standing in the kitchen when I had this strange feeling. It was so striking, so clear, that I said the words aloud. "I don't feel alone." Some instinct put my hand toward my lower stomach, and my heart started beating fast. I slowly walked to the bathroom, pulling open the drawer where I kept my pregnancy tests. I'd had my period, and this wasn't even a month where I would be using the fallopian tube I had. I heard my girlfriend's voices in my head telling me I was crazy, asking me why, if I had my period, did I insist on taking pregnancy tests and putting myself through the pain of the bad news. But the voices faded. I peed on the stick, and I read the instructions in the same ritual I had always followed, even though I knew the drill by heart. "Place on a flat surface, windows facing up." I did, and I waited, thinking, should I have waited for Eric? Was it wrong to do this alone? No, I decided. If this is a baby, it's just me and this kid right now. We have these minutes to find each other or not. Finally, I looked. Pregnant. I ran upstairs screaming. We found each other. Eric thought something was wrong because I was crying. I couldn't talk. I just handed him the pregnancy test. What I'd known for that minute, he now knew. And I watched the excitement and relief wash over him. We called everybody. My sweet mother almost tried to turn around on the highway to get to me sooner. Everybody wanted to come over, and we welcomed them. "I'm sorry I didn't call you, but I would if I'd had your number." One of my girlfriends who knew my cycles asked if I wanted to take a second test. I didn't want to pee on another stick because I didn't want it to say anything different. If this was some foolish dream, I wanted to live in it longer. I called my dad. I love my father, but he responded as a manager of a talent who had a lot of deals in the works. "Well, what are you going to do?" he asked. "What do you mean, what am I going to do?" I said. "I'm having the baby?" "No, what are we gonna do? I have all these things." "I'm sorry," I said. "Maybe do some things for you. I'm not gonna work for a bit. How about that? We're just gonna grow the business of the collection, and I'll do design meetings. And I'm not gonna go on the road." Creatively, I had been my parents' outlet for so long. My having a baby felt like an opportunity for my mother to take even more ownership of the business and for my father to put his energy and ideas into other things. I called my doctor right away, and they were scared at first because they said I was at high risk for a tubal pregnancy. They wanted me to see a specialist immediately at Cedars-Sinai Medical. When we left the gate, we had 10 cars of paparazzi following us. There was no way we could get to the hospital without putting an even bigger target on my back. Anytime a female celebrity goes to a hospital, it's like sending up a flare that paparazzi should be on high alert for a pregnancy. We were already being more cautious about protecting what we prayed would be a healthy, happy baby. So Daisy Duke's evasive driving maneuvers were no longer going to fly. We turned around and my heart sank. We made another appointment for exactly 24 hours later. We'd have time to do planning with rental cars and hiding in back seats. Another trick was to leave a rental car waiting in a paid parking garage, then drive out in a different car. We would do whatever we had to do. But more important, we prayed over my belly for that 24 hours. The prayers amounted to one word: stay. In all my years of practice, I've only seen this once, the specialist said as she walked in the office. The egg traveled from the ovary on the right side of my body to use the one fallopian tube on the left. It's a miracle, she added. Since that word came from a doctor, I decided miracle was a technical term, and I carry it with me still. And that pregnancy felt like a miracle. I loved every minute of it. I would get headaches, but never morning sickness. Within 2 weeks, Eric and I already had names picked out for a boy or a girl. I am sentimental, so the names needed to come from family. If we had that baby girl, we wanted a combination of our mother's maiden names to honor them. Maxwell Drew. For a boy, Ace Canute, our grandfather's names. Would be perfect. We found out early we were having a girl, and I was thrilled. My wish had come true. When I was pregnant with Maxwell, every sad thing in my life was forgotten or put into a healthy perspective. I know that was so much to put on her, but I couldn't help it. She saved me from all the worries, all the overthinking, all the dwelling on the past. That's why I had absolutely no problem stopping drinking during my pregnancy. I was able to turn inward instead of doing my usual escaping. I didn't want to look outward because I was just so astonished by what my body was capable of. Creating life allowed me to awaken my spirit. We decided to put off the wedding to focus on the pregnancy. We wanted to keep our secret for a while, but there was no hiding her from the media. Pretty early on, she wanted to be seen, and I had a bump I couldn't hide. For weeks, people guessed, and Eric and I decided to end the speculation by announcing the pregnancy on Halloween. I posed for a photo dressed as a mummy, old school with the white bandages tight over everything but my face and hair. I posted the shot of me cradling my stomach with the caption, "It's true, I'm going to be a mummy." When I was 4 months, I felt Maxwell kick the first time. I was like, whoa, something is really in there. It was the weirdest, most amazing feeling. My little girl was already clear about what she wanted, a combination of salty and sweet. I craved cantaloupe, but with salt all over it. Then I went through a stage of peanut butter and jelly sandwiches toasted. I would put salt on my hand, like I was taking a tequila shot, and take a bite of my sandwich. Then a lick. I ate what my body told me and would gain about 60 pounds. But I wasn't worried because I had been approached by Weight Watchers to be an ambassador when the time came to lose the pregnancy weight. I liked their message of self-empowerment, and I knew how good I was at following directions. If you tell me how to do something, I'll do it. Whenever I did an interview during my pregnancy, I was asked how I was adjusting to putting on weight. The interviewer would helpfully tell me people were commenting about my weight, even though, duh, I was pregnant. Are you held to a higher standard because you were a sex symbol? A male reporter asked me on a morning show. I think I still am a sex symbol, I answered. I know to my husband I still am. I was just so confused by the were. Excuse me? And what I said was absolutely true. During my first pregnancy, I was finally fully in my body, and I felt sexy to a point that I wanted to have sex 4 times a day. Maternity clothes were not fun for me, so I put them off as long as possible. I lived in Eric's sweatshirts, and if I had to do an event, I'd throw a jacket on a stretched-out designer dress. I joked that I was going to give birth in my YSL heels. I noticed that I could find maternity clothes that were either comfortable or cute, but never both. "Mom, we're just going to have to do this ourselves," I said. And so, the idea for the Jessica Simpson maternity line was conceived. I was so proud of how my mother had grown the business and how the business had become such a family affair. My sister Ashley even pitched in to do a campaign shoot while I was pregnant. The collection has always reflected the stages of my life, and for this, I have my mother to thank. I was able to publicly do so at my baby shower, telling her how I hoped to be half as good a mother as she was to me. Everything I had was because of her faith and love. I didn't know our lives were about to completely change, and not because of Maxwell. In late April, 3 weeks before my mid-May due date, I was in the hospital to monitor the baby. Because of her size, my doctors wanted to schedule a cesarean section 2 weeks before my due date. I was scared. And that's when my dad chose to tell me he was planning to leave my mother. He thanked me for showing him the way, leaving a life in which I felt trapped and finding the one I was meant to have. They were fighting all the time, her nitpicking everything he said. I was completely blindsided, as I knew my mother would be. I take on the problems of my friends and family, and now I was burdened with the secret that I felt responsible for. Of course, my mother knew there were problems in her marriage, but this was all she had ever known. For my survival and my daughter's protection, I buried this news. I refused to deal with it and instead focused on welcoming Maxwell. I have perspective now, or at least the hope of perspective. And I know people shouldn't be miserable, but my father's timing added a layer of terrible sadness to what had been a joyous time. For a long time, I harbored a lot of resentment about the way he told me the family I knew was over. The night before the scheduled May 1st C-section, Eric packed a record player and a selection of his old Bob Marley records to play at the hospital. I, of course, had to have my Roberto Cavalli caftan, which I had taken to wearing all the time, flowing about like some Stevie Nicks Earth Mother. They were right about her size. Maxwell entered the world on May 1st at 9 pounds 13 ounces. My miracle baby. When I held her for the first time, I couldn't believe my luck. Eric and I stared at her, knowing we had been given the truest, most precious purpose of life. When we got home, our lives revolved around Maxwell. We'd place Maxwell in a bassinet, and we'd sit outside in a shady spot by the fountain. We barely went out, preferring the world to come to us. Eric took to fatherhood as his calling. He could feel that Maxwell didn't like to be bounced, just held in stillness. He's so strong, so just one of those hands that were so famous at Yale could hold Maxwell while doing Qigong or gently walking around the yard. We hired a night nurse, Anne-Marie, to come from 7 p.m. to 9 a.m. This perfect English nanny who we peppered with questions all night. It was so odd. This feeling that someone who has been a part of you for 9 months is now next to you in a bassinet. We got up with the night nurse and we'd all watch old movies together, so even with the benefit of a nurse, I was sleep deprived. I would Google the weirdest stuff in the middle of the night. Suddenly the lightest rash was, should we call the doctor? To avoid creating more anxiety, I started night shopping. The things I would order. Maxwell had like 10 different bathtubs because I would either forget I bought one or, oh, this one has a scale. We stuck to a schedule like gospel. But breastfeeding didn't come easily to me. Not enough people talk about how tough it is, so hear it from me. It's okay if it doesn't come naturally to you either. There's enough pressure keeping this perfect little creature alive. Just do the best you can, whatever your best is. For me, breastfeeding was a time to pray over her and connect with her. You can do that while you're giving a baby a bottle, too. Carol Vanderslice, my old Sunday school teacher, came to help me. I sometimes measured my mothering skills by how much she smiled while looking at me. I loved having her there. Eric and I were fortunate to have help and be there for every first. Those first months, there was so much magic happening in our home that I had a beautiful distraction from my parents and their drama. In August, my mother discovered that my father had betrayed their marriage, just as she and I thought things were turning around for them. She had just told me what a nice time they had together on their anniversary, and she thought maybe they had turned a corner. I thought so, too. When she confronted him, my dad began calling me, and I would not pick up. One time he called while I was in my closet, looking to see what I could fit into. Maxwell was in the bassinet next to me. I watched the phone ring until it mercifully stopped. I sighed. A minute later, Eric was there. "Jessica, your dad's here," he said. "No, he's not," I thought. "He just called. He is far, far away." "What do you mean, Dad's here?" I said. "What's he going to say to me?" He had called from out front. I still thought I could hide. I looked at my baby. "Okay, Maxwell, it's you and me, kid." But suddenly my dad was there, spouting in full denial mode. After all those times he'd flirted with the idea of rescuing himself, he couldn't do it. "I'm not with anybody else," he said. "I love your mother." My anxiety made me freeze. I turned the words over and over in my mind, trying to find just the right ones to express my pain. He said he didn't want to hurt me, and that's when Eric stepped in. He said something like, "Each time you deny your own truth, something intense happens. You have to listen to the signs and take care of it yourself. Jess has no extra energy to give to you right now." I could tell that that got through to my dad. It was the type of thing he might have counseled someone back in Richardson. My parents filed for divorce that August. Dad moved on quickly, and maybe he planned it so long that he had a running start ahead of my mother. He tends to have conversations with himself for so long, and then he suddenly talks about something as if we're all supposed to be up to speed. He starts in the middle, and it can make people, well, my mom, feel lost. So I admit, I took care of my mother. In many ways, she had lost her best friend. She was 20 when she got married. She was the youngest child, and he gave her the world. She said that he didn't just give her identity. Joe Simpson was her identity. He took her out of her comfort zone. He helped her be adventurous, to see the world. Her everything had become nothing. My mom had a hard time with Ashley and me seeing our father, and I was incapable of not telling my mother when I'd spent time with Dad. So, for a long time, this daddy's girl stopped seeing him. I told him I loved him, but it was easier this way. Strong Ashley was the one who stepped up, refusing to limit herself. She and our father formed a new relationship. I'm proud of her. Sadly, this is when I had to fire my father, one of the hardest things I've ever done. The worst part was that I had to do it 5 times because he would not accept it. Too often I was circling back to people, only to find that Dad had made some move without telling me. People agreed to bad terms, thinking that's what I had demanded, when really I had no idea. It left a lot of hurt feelings I didn't know existed, and I knew I had to make the move to go forward with ownership of my own career. I did one thing to make sure my dad knew I loved him. His father had always sat in a big leather recliner. My grandfather loved that chair, and I loved to sit by it and tickle his toes and make him laugh. Dad always wanted one, but my mom's interior designer instincts wouldn't allow it. "I'm not putting a leather recliner in our house," she'd say. I bought him one. Now he could do what he wanted. While I chose to see my mother over my father, I also felt the lightest barrier forming between her and me. It was self-protection. She was hurting, And someone who's read as many self-help books as I have knows hurt people hurt people. She would say something cutting to me, and I would later turn it over in my head like a puzzle. It took me a long time to realize that when she did that, it was because she didn't like herself in that moment. She didn't want to make me cry. She only wanted to take me to the same dark place where she was. But that took a lot for me to figure out. In the meantime, I focused on my little family of three. Creating my own family within that loss was a beautiful thing. And I was about to be blessed again.